Coming up on this episode of Crime Family.
Not only there was a murder victim, but what happened to Amanda afterwards is kind of crazy as well. So as we get into this, you'll see that we have a murder victim, but also victims in other ways.
Amanda tells them that when she returned to the flat in the morning from Rafaela's house, she found the front door was open and one of the rooms had been ransacked.
So yeah, this crime scene is pretty gruesome. Upon first entering Meredith's room, all they could see was a bare foot that was sticking out from underneath the duvet. And it wasn't just the Italian media and police that were against Amanda. At least one of her friends back home had felt something was off about her as well.
So the police also noticed bloody footprints leading from Meredith's bedroom to the front door, including a clear bloody footprint on the bath mat.
Once the police kind of had their opinion about Amanda, every little thing, they were going to spin it against her. Hey everyone, welcome to Crime Family. I'm your co-host Katie, and I'm here with my brother AJ and sister Steph. And today we are going to deep dive into a very famous case. It's the Meredith Kircher murder case. And this is a case that happened overseas in Italy. So as we get into it, we'll kind of see that their judicial system and maybe some of their police work is not the same as you would expect in Canada or the US, which most of our cases come from. So that's interesting to kind of note that differences there. Also, this case, I mentioned this before, like when we talked to one of our guests one time, I said this is probably what, like the first case that really got me into true crime, the Amanda Knox case, where it was kind of not only there was a murder victim, but what happened to Amanda afterwards is kind of crazy as well. So as we get into this, you'll see that we have a murder victim, but also victims in other ways. So we have a lot to cover. This is a huge case. And let's get into it.
Yeah. So I'm going to take it away and start off with the first piece of this case. Katie spoke a little bit about her connection to the case, or I guess what she knew about the case. I knew quite a bit about the case, probably not so much as it was happening, but like definitely in the years since. Like, I'm familiar with it. And my opinion has definitely changed over the years, like from when I initially heard about it to now, like what I believe, who did it and all of that sort of stuff. So we'll get into all of that stuff as we go. But yeah, I'm going to just start off with where it all begins. Meredith Kircher grew up in South London, and at age 21, she moved to Perugia, Italy to study abroad for the year. So she was studying European politics and Italian at the University of Leeds in England. And she chose Perugia as her place of study for the year because she had taken a trip there years previously and fell in love with the city. So this is where she decided she wanted to study for her year abroad. So she officially moved to Perugia in September of 2007 for the start of the semester. And she lived in the upstairs apartment of this nice house with three other roommates. And all three of them were strangers to her. And they were all students. So two of them were from Italy, and one of them was an exchange student from the US, 20-year-old Amanda Knox. Amanda Knox is described, or definitely in the media, and the portrayal of her throughout this case, she's described as being very different from Meredith. So Meredith was more portrayed as more quiet, she was reserved and studious. Amanda was said to have a more carefree attitude and a more carefree lifestyle than her roommates, and she was just very sociable and very, very different. There's problems with that analysis based on the media's perception, which we'll get into, but Amanda was like, you know, just very kind of outgoing and sociable, and she quickly found a job in the city as a waitress. So in an interview with Megyn Kelly in 2021, Amanda is interviewed and she explains that it was mostly a media misrepresentation of her. Her and Meredith were actually quite similar. They were friends, even though, you know, they just knew each other from being roommates, but they were friends and they were actually quite similar. You know, there were times when Meredith would like to socialize and party, as most other college students would do, and that Amanda herself was portrayed as far from that. And she suggests it was likely to just place her in stark contrast to Amanda herself. So they wanted to kind of have Meredith as this sort of, you know, one end of the spectrum and Amanda as being on the other end of the spectrum and Amanda being sort of this more dark side to her than Meredith did. So that's kind of how it was sort of laid out in the media. So like I said, Amanda got a job very early on as a waitress and she got the job at a restaurant called Le Chic, or a bar. And the bar was owned by a man named Patrick Lumumba. And Patrick was a musician originally from the Congo. So Patrick says that he could tell that Amanda was a nice and caring person, but he did mention that sometimes there would be conflicts at work due to Amanda's casual working style. Like she would often stop for a while at a time and chat with the guests. And she was just very sociable, but there were many times when Patrick would have to be on her to get back to work. So although this was sometimes a problem, she and Patrick did otherwise get along at the time. So on October 25th, Amanda and Meredith, they go out to a classical music concert together because they were friends. And it's here at this event that they meet Italian student Raffaele Sollecito. And very shortly after this meeting, Amanda and Raffaele begin a whirlwind romance and seems to be moving very quickly. So October 25th, you know, they've just been in Italy for about a month or just over a month, and already she's met someone. And this case, the bulk of this case really happens or starts at the beginning of November, which is really only 1 week after Amanda and Raffaele begin dating. So very early on in their relationship. But, you know, they were just kind of in the honeymoon phase, spending all their time together, and it just moved really, really quickly. So November 2nd, 2007 is where all of the events in this case really do begin. Around 9 a.m. on the morning of November 2nd, a local resident notices that there are two cell phones in her garden. One of them is ringing. So unsure of what to make of this, she takes the phones to the telecommunications police. And in Italy, this is a special police force that deals specifically with crimes involving communications devices like cell phones. So they have that separation in the department. So if it's anything to do with communications, it would go directly to this police force. So this resident doesn't really know what to make of this ringing phone. There's two of them in her yard. So she just takes them to the police and they learn that the devices are registered to the flat where Amanda, Meredith, and their two other roommates are living. And their flat is actually only 500 meters away from where the phones were found by this resident. When the police arrive at the property, they see Amanda and Raffaele standing outside of the apartment. So they're plain clothes officers that work for this telecommunications department of the force. And so they get to the apartment after they realize this is where the phones are registered to, and they see Amanda and Raffaele outside. Amanda tells them that when she returned to the flat in the morning from Raffaele's house, she found the front door was open and one of the rooms had been ransacked. So that's what she tells these plainclothes officers when they first get there. But just shortly before that, only a few minutes before that, I believe, at 12:51 p.m., the Carabinieri, I could be totally butchering that, but that's basically the name of Italy's biggest law enforcement agency. So like the big, you know, police force that's in Italy. They receive a phone call from Raffaele reporting a break-in to his girlfriend Amanda's apartment, but did report that nothing had been taken from the home. He also said that Amanda's roommate's bedroom door was locked and that they could not access the room, which was concerning to them, especially because Amanda had been trying to call Meredith earlier and had gotten no response. So it was actually Meredith's phone that was ringing on the lawn of that local resident who turned the phone in to the telecommunications police earlier in the morning. So after the main police force get this call at 12:51 p.m., they immediately arrive at the home. And it's just interesting that these kind of two events sort of happen simultaneously and sort of on their own. So Amanda had been calling Meredith and her roommates earlier that morning, which is why the phone was ringing. But she didn't know that that was sort of setting a series of events into motion with the telecommunications police. And they had traced the phone to her apartment and that they went there. And it just so happens that they arrived like right before or right after the other police force. So those two things were happening separate from each other, which is just an interesting quarter. Kind of thing that happened. But anyway, the main police force do get there shortly after Raffaele makes the 911 call, and they get into the home and they eventually break into Meredith's bedroom. And this is where they find on the floor, there's a beige duvet, and underneath it is Meredith's bloody body. Giuliano Mignini, who's the lead prosecutor in the case, he arrives at the home just after 2 p.m., so about shortly after, like an hour later, he notices immediately that the condition of Meredith's body makes it clear that there was a sexual assault that did take place. And what's interesting to note in this case is that in Italy, many times the lead investigators of a crime, they're also the lead prosecutor in a case if that case goes to trial, which is obviously very different from how it is in here in Canada or even in the US. So when I was researching this case and watching some documentaries, I kept seeing articles that mentioned this Giuliano Mignini as the prosecutor, but he was also saying in interviews, he went to the house that day and he was doing all this investigation. I was like, what prosecutor would have been there the day of and doing all of this police work? And I was like, this must be wrong. This must be the wrong name. But then I realized, like, no, often they are the same people. So you can be the lead investigator in a case and also be the lead prosecutor when that goes to trial. So that can be definitely a conflict of interest, or you can kind of see how maybe it could be very easy if you're the investigator to cherry pick evidence or pick out things that you aren't going to think fit into a narrative. So just very interesting that that's the way that they do it there. Did you guys have sort of the same reaction when you were kind of researching this case?
I always thought like when you become a prosecutor, like you weren't allowed to be that involved in like in an investigation like that. But I find it really weird how Italy does things so differently. And you are right, though. I think there'd be a lot of conflict in that, and that it would be too much. I think it'd be too much of chaos to be the investigator and then the prosecutor at the same time. But, or maybe it's easy for them because they know exactly what's going on. There'd be nothing missed. But I don't think it should be allowed. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I feel like if you're in there doing the investigation, then you're going to know this case inside and out. So it kind of gives you an advantage as the prosecutor, right? Because you were kind of there firsthand rather than having to learn the case secondhand. So I think like that is an advantage. But yeah, it definitely could be, like you were saying, too much. You're in there, maybe have your own agenda because you saw everything with your own eyes and get too personally involved, kind of. So I can see both ways.
Yeah, I just find it weird because we see in cases where they'll call the lead investigator in into the trial. And it's like, so what does the prosecutor do? Just call himself as a witness? Like, to me, that's weird. Like, if he's the lead investigator, like, he would be calling himself as a witness to testify.
Oh, yeah, that's true. He'd be like, yeah, talking. He'd be like, yeah, and this is what I found, and I found this, and I saw this. But he's the one that's talking to everybody else, too. So that's, yeah, that is weird.
Yeah, and obviously, if you're a prosecutor, you're there to, you know, you want to make the best case, you want to get justice for the victim. And so what incentive if you're also the investigator to call out if there's any police misconduct or if, you have no incentive to do that if you are also the investigator. You're not going to call yourself out. So it's just very weird. And it's just an interesting like thing that they would even allow that to happen. But I mean, just very different.
That's a good point. And when you get into this, you kind of see how determined he was to keep Amanda on the hook for this, because I feel like maybe, yeah, he was taking it too personally because he did the investigation. He was kind of in charge of the crime scene and everything. And so if something went wrong, he kind of took it personally. So I can definitely see that as a bad thing for sure.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I feel like because we always see it in other cases where police are so focused on this one person. And when they get that wrong, it's like, oh, well, they always have like backstory of like why they thought this person was whatever, but for them to be the investigator and the prosecutors, like they're only going to focus on that one person. And like Katie said, if they get it wrong, well, who are they going to question or who are they going to out? They're going to out themselves. Like I think it's too risky to have the same person do two different jobs.
Yeah, it's just like there's no accountability really there, because, you know, you're going to have not have incentive to not want to implicate yourself in police misconduct or something like that. So just very messy. So it's just interesting that that's how they do it. But for, you know, for better or for worse, so the McNeamy man, he is the lead prosecutor, but also the lead investigator. So he goes to the crime scene very early on, just after 2 p.m. And he begins immediately searching the home for evidence along with the other detectives and the other police officers. So they're looking for DNA evidence and any other evidence that they can find. And very early on, they believe that the break-in has been staged in some way. One of the documentaries I read that covered this case said that there were glass shards from the broken window on top of Meredith's scattered clothes, which suggested that it was placed there or the window was broken after Meredith was killed. However, Katie's going to get into which window was broken. I don't really know how that kind of plays into it. It might kind of be irrelevant, but that is what one of the documentaries that I saw mentioned. So I just wanted to throw it in there. But that was one of the things that the police kind of stuck out to them as maybe this was staged. There was also a rock on the floor in one of the bedrooms, and police thought it looked much too big and heavy to have been thrown from the ground to the top floor window, and too large to fit through the space between the shutters or between the shutters in the window. So there were glass pieces at the top and at the bottom of the window. It was really the middle part that had been broken out. But the rock that was on the floor looked like it was much too big to fit in that space, and it likely would not fit, or it would have taken out all the glass in the window and not just that part that was broken. So that was kind of one instant inconsistency that really stuck out to the police as kind of maybe the break-in was staged in some way by someone.
Yeah, and just to get into a little bit more detail about this, some of this was covered in the Case File podcast episode on this case, and some of the stuff I think is important. So the rock that was thrown in, some sources say that it came through Philomena's window, not Meredith's window, and it was found in Philomena's room. And so that window in her room had wooden shutters on it, and Philomena insisted that she had closed those shutters. And for those shutters to have been opened from the outside, they would have to have been pried open forcefully. And the shutters were found intact with no damage, and they were just slightly ajar. So it seems reasonable to suggest that for the rock to go through the window but not damage the shutters at all, they would already have to have been open and not swung open because the rock hit them, because there would obviously be some damage to them. They point out that to do that from the outside, this person would have had to pry open those shutters forcefully. And in order to do that, this Case File episode says that someone would have had to scale the wall to open the window and then go back down, throw the rock up through the window, and then scale the wall again to go through the window. And this window was like 3.5 meters off the ground, so it would have been difficult for someone to even have to scale that once, let alone scale it, go back down, have to scale it again. Just seems like a lot of work for someone that's trying to break into a house. Also, the ground outside the window was damp and muddy, but there was no indication that anyone had been down there, and no indication that anyone had made that climb up there. Also, there was nothing under the window to help anyone get up there, except for there was like a small nail that was sticking out like halfway up the wall to the window. But if someone was using that as a step, you would expect that it would be bent or muddy or even fall out, but there was no indication that anyone had used that as a step to get up to the window. Also, the vegetation or the garden underneath the window had not been trampled at all, so it seemed obvious that nobody had even been under there. And also, this window was like would have been like the worst choice for someone to try and get through because it was facing the street, so anyone that was outside could have easily seen someone like trying to crawl up through this window, while the other two bedroom windows were in the back of the house. And one of those windows actually had a table and chair underneath it, apparently. And so if you were scouting out this house to break into it, you'd think that would be the one you'd use. There's literally things underneath it to step up onto. And so that would have been the logical choice. But yeah, it just seems suspicious that all of that happened the way it did. And the scene looked super staged. So just super weird.
Yeah, and that's why one of the thing I mentioned before is like, because one of the documentaries I watched said that they kind of thought it might have been staged because the glass shards were on top of Meredith's clothes rather than under it. Because obviously if you break in, then the clothes that are scattered would be on top of the glass, not the other way around. But when your research says that it was actually Philomena's room that was broken into, it's like, then I don't really know what that significance of the glass on top of Meredith's clothes would be, because it wasn't her room that was broken into. So that was just interesting, unless it got transferred from one room to the other somehow, which is possible. But that was just one thing that I saw that was like, I'm not really sure. If it was Philomena's room, then just I don't know what that means about the glass shard on top of Meredith's clothes. So the police also noticed bloody footprints leading from Meredith's bedroom to the front door, including a clear bloody footprint on the bath mat in the bathroom. So Amanda provides her story of what happened because she was the first one to enter the apartment. Based on her story, she's the first one to enter the apartment after the crime had happened. And so she was kind of the first one in there. So she gives the story and she says that she spent the night of November 1st at her boyfriend Raffaele's apartment. They smoked weed, they watched movies, they had sex. An eyewitness confirms that Amanda and Raffaele were in the apartment, in Raffaele's apartment, until 8:40 p.m. So that's been corroborated. Also, records show that someone ordered the movie Amelie on Raffaele's laptop. So there is evidence to show that he and Amanda were at Raffaele's apartment until at least 8:40. They watched that movie. So that part of their night is accounted for. So she slept over at his apartment, and then she says that she went home early in the morning of November 2nd, and she discovers the front door to her apartment open. So she said that the latch on the door was sometimes a little bit tricky and didn't always work right. So maybe it seemed perfectly explainable that the door would come ajar, maybe if it didn't latch all the way, and then maybe the wind would swing it open or something. So maybe the front door being open isn't something that would be entirely alarming to her, as you would think just from an outsider of like, your front door is wide open. That's kind of weird. So then she says, she goes into the apartment. Everything seems fine. Like there's nothing that's noticeably, nothing's out of place. Like nothing seems like anything's wrong. So she goes to take a shower. She claims that Raffaele had like a crummy shower. And so she would rather just go to her own apartment to shower, which is why she did that. Her apartment was only a 5-minute walk from Raffaele, so it was a quick, kind of easy walk back and forth. So she goes in to take a shower. She says that she noticed that there were a few spots of blood in the bathroom sink, but just, quote, speckles, end quote. So she couldn't be certain the source of it. So it wasn't like it was a pool of blood. It wasn't like a bunch of splatters. It was just a few little drops of blood. So she said, you know, she thought, like, that's not nothing to get, like, super alarmed about right away. Like, who knows what could have, maybe someone cut their finger, didn't, you know, wash the sink properly or something. So, again, nothing that really jumped out to her as alarming right away. And she tells Diane Sawyer in an interview on ABC's 2020 in 2013 that it wasn't until after she showered that she noticed the bloody footprint on the bath mat. So when she gets out, she sees this bloody footprint. But again, not something that's, like, super jumps out to her right away or super alarming. Like, what do you guys think? If you guys went and saw like a few drops in like a bathroom sink, like that's not something you guys would really like think about right away, right? As something went terribly wrong, or even like a footprint on the bath mat.
The blood in the sink to me would be like somebody cut their finger, but the bloody footprint on the mat is kind of suspicious to me. Like, I don't know, unless you cut yourself in the bathroom or cut your foot and then stepped on the mat, but normally wouldn't leave a huge bloody footprint like that.
Yeah. Also, some reports, like Amanda said that she had just had her ears pierced, and so she thought maybe it could have just been her blood that came from her ears because they just were freshly pierced. So that, I mean, if I bleed in the sink, I'm going to clean it up right away, but that's just me. But the footprint on the mat is like alarming to me because, you need a good amount of blood to have a footprint show up in it. So I think that, to me, would be the sketchiest thing. Like, something happened to somebody here. Why is there so much blood?
Yeah, and I don't know if she mentions, if there was blood in the shower as well or something, but just on the bath mat and in the sink, what she noticed anyway, right away. She also says that she noticed, like, in the bathroom, that the toilet in the flat second bathroom hadn't been flushed, and there was feces in the toilet. So this was what she says was alarming to her. Because this is what made her feel like, you know, none of her roommates would have done that. They were very, very on top of cleanliness. So it's never, it's something that would be totally out of character. Like no one would just not flush. So she thought this is kind of eerie to her and made her think that someone had else had been in the apartment at some point to do that. So she kind of found all of these things together once she saw that to be odd. And so she says that she went back to Raffaele's apartment and she told him what she had saw. They both later returned to the apartment together to further check into what was going on. So Amanda was obviously concerned enough to bring it up to Raffaele when she gets back to his place, but not alarmed enough by seeing all that stuff to call the police immediately. So it's just interesting she went to his place first. But I guess you don't really want to call unless you're for sure something happened. Like, you know, if you call and then it turns out to be fine, maybe you just want to avoid that. So I can see also that perspective as well. So Amanda says that she began trying to call all of her roommates either while she was still at the apartment or maybe on her walk over to Raffaele's or when she was at Raffaele's. She did try to call her roommates. And the only one that she was able to get a hold of was her Italian roommate, Filomena. And it was Filomena that was concerned. And she told Amanda to go back to the apartment with her and figure out what was going on. So also keep in mind that I believe it was November 1st. It was a long weekend, like it was a holiday on November 1st. So the other roommates had actually left for the holiday weekend. So none of them were there except for Meredith on the night of the 1st. So Amanda really was that first one in the apartment because the other roommates were gone. So it was Filomena who said, like, no, this is kind of sketchy. Go back and see what happened. So it's when Amanda and Raffaele go back together, they open up the door to Filomena's room. And that's when they find it ransacked with the window broken, things like that. And the other roommate, I think it's pronounced like Lada, is how Amanda says it, but I think it's like spelt like Laura. I'm not sure, but the other roommate, her room was untouched. And so they also, this is when they realized that Meredith's door was locked. So they were trying to like checking all the rooms and they couldn't get into Meredith's room. So that's when Raffaele calls the police. And it's minutes after that when the plainclothes telecommunications officers, like I said before, they arrived because of the cell phones they had found. And they weren't there because of the call that Raffaele just made minutes before. The plainclothes officers tell them that the phones belong to her roommate, Filomena, but they were lent to Meredith. So the phones found were Filomena's actual phones, but she had given them to Meredith to use. And so by the time the main police force, the Carabinieri, arrive at the scene, Filomena has come back to the apartment. Her boyfriend and some of their friends have descended on the house, and they discuss with the police whether or not they're allowed to break down Meredith's door since it's considered private property. And so they kind of have that discussion for a few minutes, but ultimately they break down the door, and that's when they notice the crime scene and Meredith's dead body underneath the duvet on the floor of her bedroom. So that's kind of what Amanda describes as a series of events that morning leading to the discovery of the body.
So yeah, this crime scene is pretty gruesome. Upon first entering Meredith's room, all they could see was a bare foot that was sticking out from underneath the duvet. And once the homicide investigators arrived, that's when they lifted up the blanket and found Meredith deceased underneath. And she was naked except for a long sleeve shirt, and her pants sat crumpled in a pile beside her. And they also found her bloody bra, which they determined had been cut off post-mortem. There was also a pile of blood-soaked towels lying next to her, and it was clear that there was a struggle and a beating had taken place, as there were many cuts and bruises on Meredith's body. Most of these injuries were on her face and neck. It was also determined that her hyoid bone had been fractured, so that's the bone in your neck that is often broken when someone is strangled, or a forceful hit could also fracture this bone. So they also indicated that it looked like someone had tried to suffocate her due to the bruises around her nose and mouth. There was evidence that she was forced to kneel down with her hands behind her back and her face slammed into the floor. And they had found little nicks on her neck, which made it look like maybe she was forced at knife point into that position. And she was sexually assaulted. Her throat had actually been slit twice, and her body was dragged closer to the bed. And so they found blood in her lungs, which indicates that she had survived for at least a few minutes after her throat had been slit, and she choked on her own blood, which is what they think probably ultimately killed her. So obviously this is a very brutal, vicious attack, and an extremely scary and awful way to die. And I only mention all these details, like it's not necessary to go into these details all the time, but I just wanted to mention them all because you have to be like a special, sick, violent type of person to be able to do that to somebody else. So someone with anger issues or someone that has rage issues or violent tendencies. And so you would have to believe that Amanda and Raffaele would be capable of that type of violence towards someone, like towards their own friend. And to me, when you see interviews with, I mean, we'll probably go into this later, but when you see interviews with Amanda and Raffaele, they just don't seem like the kind of people that have that kind of rage in them that could unleash on a friend like that. Investigators do say the fact that the blanket was placed over her after she had died, that that's typically a sign of remorse, and killers usually do this when they know the victim. So I think that's one thing they noticed right away and figured that, oh, someone that knew Meredith well, or at least enough to feel bad, had done this to her. So that's just interesting to note.
Overall, a very bloody and gruesome crime scene. And upon discovery of the body, so everyone is kind of escorted out of the house, and people are, of course, hysterical, especially Amanda's roommate, Philomena. So almost immediately, we see a very suspicious cloud kind of being hovered over Amanda and Raffaele. And it seems like the police and the media, very shortly after, they kind of quickly speculate that she was somehow involved, or she knows something that she's not saying. They try to point to inconsistencies in her account of that morning and all of that sort of thing. And as we've talked about in many cases before, it's really Amanda's behavior and seeming lack of horrified reaction to the murder that really struck people as odd. So I'm sure if you know this case, you've probably seen that news footage of Amanda and Raffaele outside of the apartment and kind of their reactions versus some of the other people who were at the scene. So Amanda does say in that interview she has on Megyn Kelly's podcast in 2021 that people for years compared her reaction to that of Philomena's to kind of point to Amanda's guilt, saying that Philomena was hysterical, she was crying, and she was freaking out, as, you know, one should after a gruesome discovery, and that Amanda, by comparison, while looking sad and kind of out of it, just lacked the emotional or empathetic reaction that people expected. Amanda does say, though, that there was a massive reason that she can point to for why her reaction was like that. She says Philomena actually saw inside Meredith's bedroom, and she saw the crime scene with her own eyes because she was right there when the bedroom door was broken down. Amanda, however, was in the kitchen with Raffaele and never actually saw Meredith's body or the crime scene with her own eyes. So for someone who saw the crime scene, it'd be much more understandable to be horrified, hysterical, and heavily traumatized by that. But maybe having never seen it, like, Amanda probably could disconnect from it in a different way that from the outside is seen as cold and suspicious, but it's just because maybe she didn't actually have that image in her mind that she was reverting back to. So it is easier to disconnect in that way. She said she was more like confused and just overall like fearful, but not like hysterical like Philomena. So that's kind of Amanda's detailed account of the evening of November 1st and then the morning of November 2nd. And as we saw in previous cases, the tunnel vision of the police was pretty next level and seemed like very early on they were determined to make Amanda the scapegoat for this crime, whether she was guilty or not.
Sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to say, like, we always see these in case, like, in every case that we do, how people who are accused, like, they always, they're not reacting the way that the investigator think they should react. Or if they're acting too much, it's like they're putting on a show. So when they said that Amanda didn't look concerned or didn't look that upset, it's like, well, everybody has different emotions and different ways that they express their emotions. So I can't stand when people say, like, oh, they just don't, like, care. It's like, well, she cares. It's just that her emotions are different than everybody else. I don't know, this just really annoys me, but they always have to talk about their emotions, but we all know, like, people grieve and have different emotions for different things.
Yeah, like we've said a million times, I don't think there's a right way where someone would be like, oh yeah, that's appropriate, because no matter what you do, someone's always going to have something to say about it, so
yeah,
kind of have to just take it as it is.
Yeah, and I almost feel like we're being so repetitive at this point, because we say the same thing every case. Like, people are like, why are you acting that way? But maybe this is the first episode you've seen or listened to of us, so you're hearing this, our comments on this, for the first time. But it happens in many cases. Even the last one we did with the Scott Peterson, Lacey Peterson, like, it's the same thing. And also, people, once they decide that you're guilty, it doesn't matter what you do, they're going to find a reason to believe that. So that's, like, initially the first thing the police just latched onto was this lack of emotion, I guess, from Amanda, which we all know is ridiculous.
I know. Yeah, the conversation about how you're supposed to act is, you know, kind of getting old, because we do talk about it all the time. But also, Amanda herself even describes herself as you know, quirky and kind of different than other people. So maybe there's still, that's, to her, that's a normal way to react because, you know, she's not the same as everybody else or whatever. So she probably didn't think it was weird, while other people are like, oh, that's super weird. But that's just who she is. Anyway, even though the police were very focused on Amanda and Raffaele from the get-go, to their credit, they did check out a few other people as well in the beginning of the investigation. So Amanda and Meredith and their two roommates lived on the top floor of their house, and below them lived a group of guys that they sometimes hung out with. They got along with them. They were kind of friends. And Meredith reportedly was seeing one of these men, but they were all quickly ruled out as suspects due to all of them having solid alibis. I think most of them weren't even there that weekend because it was a holiday. So the police did kind of shortly look at other people, and then they quickly went back and focused on Amanda and Raffaele. Very early on, the police wiretapped Amanda and Raffaele's cell phones to try and get some incriminating details out of them, but they ultimately got nothing. And they again pointed out that they seemed too nonchalant for having just found out about the gruesome murder. Additionally, the media got a hold of the fact that Amanda was out shopping just days after the murder, buying underwear and clothes with Raffaele, but it's reported that all of Amanda's belongings, including her clothes, were a part of the crime scene and she wasn't allowed to remove them. So she didn't really have a choice. If she wanted to change her clothes, she had to go and buy some new stuff. And some sources say that they were picking out lingerie together. They were not acting appropriately in the stores. But I mean, who's to say what really happened, right? Whether you think buying underwear after a murder is inappropriate. If you don't have any clean underwear, maybe it's not. I don't know. But it's just like things got blown out of proportion.
Yeah. Are you just never allowed to go to a store again after a crime? I don't know. After you witness a crime?
Well, it had to consume your entire life after a crime. So yeah, it's kind of crazy. And it wasn't just the Italian media and police that were against Amanda. At least one of her friends back home had felt something was off about her as well. So in the days following the murder, on November 4th, Amanda wrote an email to some friends back in Seattle. And she wrote it because she just wanted others to know what had happened from her point of view and just kind of see, or just kind of know how she felt. And I can totally understand that because she's in this foreign country and doesn't have her close family and friends around her. So it's understandable why she would kind of want to get everything off her chest to people that she was really close to and trusted. And so she wrote about the details from her perspective about the night of Meredith's murder and when her body was found. And after that, she continued to write about her future plans and that she was looking for a new apartment, but she said she was bummed that she still had to pay the next month's rent for that house that Meredith had died in, that she currently lived in. And so she also wrote about going back to class the following week and how she didn't want to keep talking to people about what had happened. If everyone kept asking her about it, she was just kind of tired of talking about it. She signs the email saying she's feeling okay and that she hoped everyone was well. And so one of her friends that received this email back in Seattle thought that this was such an odd email, and they were so taken aback that they actually forwarded it to the police. Maybe this email was a bit out of place, but to me, like, it doesn't stand out as super alarming. Like we were just saying, like, you have to expect that not every single conversation you have after a crime is going to be about that murder, right? I mean, she has her own life and she would need to have other conversations. So not talking about the crime constantly and maybe talking about, you know, her plans in the future, what she's thinking is super normal, you know, just for her own sanity, because you can't just let that consume your life. And you often hear about survivor's guilt and like family members feeling guilty about laughing or smiling again after a loved one has passed. But like, obviously you have to understand life goes on and you can't let a tragedy consume you forever. And I know this had only been a couple days. It was very recent, but still, you have to be able to have a casual conversation with your best friends about something different. So that, it, to me, obviously I haven't seen the email, I don't know the context, but it just doesn't seem that alarming.
I was just gonna say, I think she wrote the email just to see, like, just to have her perspective, but she also wrote the email just to, like, be in contact with people back home because she probably was feeling lonely and didn't have anybody else to talk to, and she didn't want them to think anything, like, they, she didn't want to think there's anything wrong with her and that she was safe. So I don't really put any thought to the email. I think she was just trying to connect with people back home.
Well, yeah. Can you imagine if one of your best friends or like your sibling, their roommate just got murdered and they're in a foreign country? Like, you would be like, what's happening? Like, how are you? What happened? Like, what's going on? And so maybe her, rather than having to repeat the same thing over and over again, she's like, I'm just going to tell everybody in this email about what's happening and then update them on other things besides the murder as well. So to me, it just seems like a normal thing to do. And you have to vent, let your feelings out, right? About other things that are going on in your life.
But it's just unfortunate that one friend thought it was suspicious and decided to like bring it forth to the police. Like, to me, it's just an email of how she's feeling, and she's just wanted to make sure everybody at home was okay. There's nothing suspicious to me in that email. I mean, like I said, like Katie said, I didn't see the email, so I don't really know what all was in it. But from the sounds of it, it was just like a normal, heartfelt email that she wanted to make sure everybody was okay at home.
And I think what Katie said, too, like, she has to vent to people, like, she's in a foreign country. All these people are new to her. She doesn't know anyone there, even though she's really close to Raffaele. But she's only known him for a week at this point, or just over a week. Like, you know, she wants to maybe talk to and relate to and vent to people who she knows more closely back home. So I don't really get that. And also, I feel like you could also make the argument, too, from the other perspective of, like, if someone was in on it and they did do something and they were involved, like, they might try to overcompensate and like might send a really sad email saying how sad they are and how depressed they are and all of this stuff. So that can also be scrutinized from the other perspective. Like, oh, this person's, you know, hamming it up for all their friends back home, like trying to make it seem like they're so sad. So again, it kind of goes to, you can't really win if you're someone that the police just kind of decide that they're going to think is guilty, right? Like, it doesn't really matter what you do at that point. So it can be spun from the other way. I don't really see the email as anything too like severe, really.
Yeah, exactly. Once the police kind of had their opinion about Amanda, every little thing, they were going to spin it against her, which is like exactly what they do, as we'll get into. And like, yeah, Amanda can't catch a break, it seems like. Even one of her friends, wasn't against her, but you know, sent that to the police, which was really shitty for Amanda, I think. And as we get further into this case, we'll outline the media's relentless ridiculing of Amanda's character and the police's determination to take Amanda down for the murder of Meredith Kircher.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, Katie said, we'll get into more about the media, because I think this case more than the other ones, I mean, the other ones were media too, but this one really did have like heavy influence of the media and how they spun the story to fit their narrative. So we're going to go into that and we're going to kind of take it up from there, because we've just only described the initial crime scene and like the day of or the days after. So we're going to kind of get into what takes place and sort of the arrests that happen shortly after that. So that is where we are going to leave it off for the first part of the Meredith Kircher case. So as always, you can follow us on all the social medias if you would like. We're at Crime Family Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and we're at Crime Family Pod 1 on X. And you can get the merch for the merch store if you would like, and to support the show, we'll put the link to that in the show notes. Also, you can become a patron. If you do become a patron, you can get early access to our episodes. We release them up to a week early for all the patrons, and you also get ad-free content as well as bonus episodes throughout the season. So we'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. And as always, please, you know, give us a review, give us a rating on whichever app you listen to us on. We really appreciate your feedback. You can send us an email at crimefamilypodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of this case, your opinions. And we're also on YouTube, so you can follow us at Crime Family Podcast there. All of our episodes are on there, and we'd love to interact with you in the comment section of the YouTube channel as well. So thank you so much. We hope you've enjoyed part one of our Meredith Kircher murder case deep dive. There's lots more to come in the remaining three parts, so stay tuned. We'll be back next week with part two. So until then, take care. Bye.
Bye.